Lesson 9 here. While you're getting seated, let me make just a couple of comments. If you're interested in tapes, fill out that tape order form in the back. It is perforated very microscopically. You can fold that and it'll come out a nice little rip and won't tear up your book. And leave those back at the resource center back there with your check for that order, and they will be putting those together. And the other thing is, we haven't exactly nailed down what topic we'll do next year, but this summer seminar will be the same week in June, this last week in June, next year. And got a couple of things stirring around. I'm really chomping at the bit to begin another book, and I don't know how far along it will be at that time, but we'll see. There's several things I can't wait to get done with so I can get started on that. But tentatively, what is in my mind is doing a book called God is More Than Enough. And so we'll see. If that isn't very far along, then I have another option that we'll put in here and perhaps some counselor training and help you learn how to counsel other people or counsel yourself. But we'll see. I really would like to shoot for a book if I can get very far down the road. So that's where we are. And the evaluation form, if you would fill that out and leave that on the table. You could leave that on the table as you leave tonight or tomorrow morning when you leave. We're still on discourse number 4, The Secret of Perseverance. And the title is, What's a Mortal to Do? Years ago, when all TV was black and white, it seemed like, there was a television commercial, I think, for Tide or some detergent, and this little boy, he'd get all messed up out in the mud, and his mother would look at it, and she would look at the camera and say, what's a mother to do? And, of course, the answer was, Tide, you know, or whatever the answer was, or whatever the commercial was for, whatever product, but What is a mortal to do in all of, how do we persevere in all of this? We have the unsolved mysteries that goad us. Do a little kickstart here. Unsolved mysteries, we learn we have to persevere wisely. Back in Ecclesiastes 9:11 gives new meaning to that passage, Ecclesiastes 9:11. I returned and saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, neither yet brave, bread to the wise, nor yet riches to men of understanding, nor yet favor to men of skill, but time and chance happen to them all. And he's not talking about everything is just a fate like Omar Khayyam was talking about, but it seems like it's just unpredictable. But he gives us the reality that God is working in all of these things. And go back to chapter 8 and look at verses 16 and 17. We touched on these. He says, when I applied mine heart to know wisdom and to see the business that is done upon the earth, for there is neither day nor night see asleep with his eyes, then I beheld all the work of God, that a man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun, because though a man labor to seek it out, yet he shall not find it. This is that intentional mystery. Yea, further, though a wise man think to know it, yet shall he not be able to find it. And that reminds us, God has injected life with intentional mystery to teach us dependence. And he says, I want you to persevere wisely, not foolishly in this world of mystery. Real men do ask directions. When they face mystery, they don't just keep plunging on. They stop and reflect. They ask, God, what are you saying? What do you want? Solomon says, there's plenty of mystery to throw you off track. Persevere wisely, not foolishly, but also persevere boldly, not fearfully, in the world of mystery. After 9/11, Mayor Giuliano and President Bush, Pastor Bush, Pastor Vaughn and President Bush, you going to run for president, Pastor? No, okay. President Bush would say, you know, folks, we can't let this stop our normal activities. We just have to keep going on. We'll do our best to find out what's going, you know, to try to stop terrorism, all that, but we can't let this cripple us. We have to keep moving on. That was good advice. And that's exactly what Solomon is going to say here. You have to persevere boldly. Yes, there's a lot of uncertainty. But you can't let that paralyze you. You have to keep moving. And he's going to say, persevere boldly, not fearfully. In light of life's mysteries, number one in your notes, in light of life's mysteries, get on with the business of life. We're in chapter 11 now. He says, verse 1, cast thy bread upon the waters, for thou shalt find it after many days. Now he's talking there about, probably, about investment in commerce. Just keep going. Get busy with the business of life. It's the admonition that you can't reap unless you sow. So don't just be paralyzed here because of all this uncertainty. Get sowing. Get doing the thing you ought to be doing. And he says, secondly, be responsibly generous and prudent. Verse 2, give a portion to 7 and also to 8, for thou knowest not what evil shall be upon the earth. Basically, he's saying, okay, so there is a lot of uncertainty. Still give 100%. Put out your 7 and then some. 7 is a number of perfection. Give your portion to 7. Get out there. Ratchet yourself up to 7 and then give 8. 110%. Don't be paralyzed because of their uncertainty. Be responsibly generous and prudent and acknowledge life's uncertainty. Verse 3. This is a great one to put above your dining room table too. If the clouds be full of rain, they empty themselves upon the earth, and if the tree fall toward the south or toward the north, in the place where the tree falleth, there it shall be. Now that's a truth, isn't it? Wherever the tree falls, that's where it fell. That's what he's saying here. He's saying there is uncertainty. And he says, you know, the winds don't consult anybody. The trees don't consult anybody. It looks like it's a very uncertain thing. You can't second guess the circumstances. Be responsibly generous. Acknowledge life's uncertainties, but don't retreat to inactivity. Watch out for the paralysis of analysis. There's some of us who run things over in our heads trying to find out every possible thing that could go wrong and every possible solution for it. We spend so much time thinking about it, we never get it done. That's called the paralysis of analysis. You know what the Bible calls it? It's a spirit of fear. 2 Timothy 1:7. God says, I didn't give you a spirit of fear. Why do we analyze and scrutinize and agonize over some of these things over and over and over again? I mean, we're just talking about what car we buy or what house we buy. I mean, these are big investments. But there's some people who just agonize over everything to such an extent they don't get anything done. What is behind that? Fear. And all of the uncertainty. I can't move unless I know exactly what's going on. I have to know the answer. Don't give me any surprises. I've got to know what's going on. I don't like surprises. I have my life all worked out. I've got a 5-year plan and a 10-year plan and a 15-year plan, and I've got a contingency plan for those if those don't work out, and I've got a contingency plan if plan B doesn't work. Now, some of us aren't that organized, but I've got this all worked out, and we spend so much time keeping our lists and our lists of our lists that we never get the shopping done. We spend all our time redoing our lists. And that's what he's saying here. Look, life is uncertainty, but get on with it. Yes, you don't know where the tree's going to fall. Well, you know, if I go outside and if I drive down there, I might get hit. Or and this gets into a lot of things that happen with anxiety disorders. I mean, you get in the middle of the amphitorium and the flu bug's been kind of going around your family. And it hits you real bad in the middle of a service. And you know, I've got to leave, or it's going to get worse. You know, So you leave in the middle of that amphitheater. I mean, it's seating 6,000 people. And you have to leave in the middle of it and walk out and use the bathroom. Uncertainty of life. You don't know when the flu bug's going to get a hold of you. So then what do you start thinking the next time you walk into the amphitheater for chapel? I might have to walk out again. What if I have to walk out again? I mean, the flu has passed. You haven't had those disorders, stomach disorders, for, you know, several days, and you have been normal. But just walking into the same building, you think, what if this happens again? And then you start getting some butterflies in your stomach, and you think, oh, it is happening again. I've got to sit in the back, and I've got to sit by an aisle. And then you get through that day. You couldn't pay any attention to what's going on in the sermon because you're just trying to measure what kind of feelings are going on in the gastrointestinal portion of your being. And then the next day you go to chapel and you know, just the thought that when the bell rings and it's 10:50 and the bell rings and you know chapel is next, all of a sudden your stomach just kind of goes, you know what I'm saying? I mean, you've never had that happen, but have you ever known anybody that happened to that kind of thing? And you know what happens? We start analyzing everything. Well, what if this happens if I do that? And you can get yourself to the point where you won't even leave your house. I mean, Patty and I have worked with folks who won't even leave their house because of all of that. You know what's happening? There's been uncertainty in their life, and they're absolutely paralyzed by it. And Solomon says, look, you persevere boldly, not fearfully. The tree is going to fall where it falls. If you got to throw up, you're going to throw up. Now, if you know you're going to have problems, then it's probably best not to go to a public function. But you usually can predict that you're pretty well, you know, where you are on the track of that illness, and you can, you know, the prudent foreseeth the evil coming and hideth himself, Proverbs says. But the simple pass on and are punished, you know. Well, but we can make all kinds of uncertainty in our lives, all kinds of problems in our lives by, yes, the world is full of uncertainty. Trees are going to fall and they're going to fall. We don't know where they're going to fall ahead of time. And you can absolutely paralyze yourself. And he says, don't retreat to inactivity in verse 4. He says, he that observeth the wind shall not sow. And he that regardeth the clouds shall not reap. What is he saying? If you're always checking the weather and saying, oh, well, you know, boy, it might be a bad day. I better not do that today because it might be a problem today. You keep checking out all of the possibilities. You won't get anything done. And it says, yes, the life is full of uncertainty. But there's a God in heaven controlling the uncertainty. Don't get into that retreat to inactivity. That is a spirit of fear. And God said, that did not come from me. Say, well, I'm just being responsible. I mean, if you got to walk out in the middle of service, you don't want to upset a lot of people and distract a lot of people. I'm just being responsible. No, I'm being fearful. There is nothing happening in my gastrointestinal tract that says that I've got a problem coming along. But I can create one. Life's uncertainties cannot be met, point A. Don't attack them. This is intensity. There are other people, instead of pulling back from their problems, and some people avoid everything and retreat into activity. Other people attack with intensity. You know, I don't recommend these at all, but you can take these little personality tests of what kind of a dog you are, you know, like you might be a German, a German Shepherd. Your whole attitude in life is guard the yard, make sure everybody's abiding by the policies. Then there are other people who are collies, you know, they just like to help people out, you know, and loyal, faithful collie kind of person. Then there are people in life who are Doberman pinchers. The difference between a German Shepherd and a Doberman pincher is that a German shepherd, if you walk into the yard, he will chew you up. You cross the line and you get shredded. A Doberman pincher will go outside of the yard, grab you and pull you into the yard, and then chew you up. He's out looking for a fight. You know, he's in attack mode. Well, there's some people who handle life like that, they with a lot of intensity. This intensity, as avoidance, both of these, are the smoke in the house that says you're depending on yourself to make it happen. My dad used to say, and it didn't apply to this necessarily, but sometimes, you know, when we're really grunting and groaning, trying to get a nut uncracked or something, he would say, "Don't force it, son, just get a bigger hammer." Well, intense people get bigger hammers. They meet uncertainty with great effort and energy. They are, after all, they're self-insured. I've got to make sure this doesn't happen. And everybody's going to stay out of my way. You're not going to mess with my life or my things or whatever. And they push and they yell and they manipulate and they scheme and they bribe and they coerce. I remember hearing, listening to a woman like that dealing with one of her children. And she said, and the way she would manipulate her children, she's a very controlling person. Everybody had to do what she said. And she would say to her little girl, "Honey, now be a good little girl and go help and go do this for mommy." You understand how manipulative that is? And she coerces. And you know what Dr. Fremont called these kind of women? He called them she bulls. That's not very flattering, but the kind that just force and push and manipulate, and they're going to get it done. And sometimes people aren't that intense, and sometimes these kinds of people are known as the Energizer bunnies. I mean, they're always out there doing everything there, because after all, when you're self-insured, you have a lot of work to do to make sure all the loose ends are tied up. But the Energizer bunny becomes the terrorizer rabbit. Anybody who gets in your way gets your wrath too. And kind of the attitude is, God doesn't seem to be doing enough, I have to do something. Or, after all, he's left me to do all of this stuff, so I got, you know, doesn't God help those who help themselves? No, I'm helping myself. Often they become very highly perfectionistic, they have ideas of how it should be done, and they expend great energy trying to make that ideal thing happen, and eventually they become very, very discouraged. I can tell you that the majority of depressed people that I get referred to me from the clinic are highly perfectionistic people. Because if it has to be ideal and it has to be perfect, living on a fallen planet, after a while, folks, that gets real discouraging because it doesn't happen that way down here. The trees fall this way and they fall that, and you can't predict which way they're going to fall. And if it's important for you to have it all together exactly right, that's a real this is a very frustrating planet to live on. And the Energizer bunnies, Energizer bunnies' batteries eventually wear down and they get very depressed, very discouraged. Let me give you a couple examples of this. Over the years, Patty and I have dealt with several students who had disturbing physical problems stemming from this approach. Her name was not Karen, but I'll call her Karen. This is maybe 10, 15 years ago. It's been a while back. She was a piano pedagogy major, a piano performance major. I don't remember which. Phenomenal piano player. And she's coming up her second semester of her senior year, and she has her senior recital. And this is not just playing an offertory in church. A senior recital for piano, when that's your major, this is a major thing to do. And about the beginning of that semester, she began to develop a great deal of numbness in her right hand. And eventually, she lost the feeling in that hand altogether within just a couple of short weeks. And, of course, she was over at our clinic, and they referred her to a neurologist because that could be a very serious thing going on in her wrist. And he checked out everything possible, and everything was connected right, and he said, basically, you need to see a psychiatrist. And so she didn't feel like she ought to be doing that, so she ended up on my doorstep and crying, and she said, I need a psychiatrist, and I don't think I ought to go to one, so can you help me? And I said, well, let's talk. And she told me the story, how things were just, she's losing feeling in her hands and becoming very, very numb. And in fact, at that point, she couldn't use her hand. And she was having somebody else take all of her notes. And this is pretty disturbing because you're a senior coming up in your senior recital and you're supposed to be able to use your hand to play the piano. And she's very, very disturbed. And I said, why all the intensity about piano? And as I talked with her, it was obvious she was a very intense kind of person. Everything had to be just right. And just the way she dressed and the way she put on her makeup, everything was just perfect. And she said, it goes way back. She said, when I was in junior high, now this is 15 years ago now, and that would have been maybe 7 or 8 years before that. So we're talking about maybe 20 some years back. Her mom and dad divorced in a fundamental church. Well, 25 years ago, that just didn't happen. And it was a huge scandal in the church, and her dad left the home. And she was going to her mission became in life to prove to her dad that this would not mess her up. She was going to make something of her life, even though he was going to be a jerk and leave the family. And so for all of these years, she has been intensely trying to be absolutely top on everything she could be to prove to her dad that you're not going to mess up my life. There's a lot of bitterness in that. And there was a lot of anger in that. And a lot of fear in that, that something would go wrong and would mess it up. And guess what was happening? Something was going wrong. And God really convicted her of what was going on in her life. And she repented of the anger and of the bitterness, and God just broke her. I mean, He had her. Her life was out of control. Her way of making life work was to control it. And God had taken it out of control. And within about 7 or 8 days, her hand was back. And she played her piano recital, and that year she won the commencement concert at BJU, the commencement contest for piano at BJU. And at the awards ceremony, she came up after I was sitting on the platform where the dean sit, and she came back to me after that, and she was holding her her ribbon with a medallion, and she said, Dr. Berg, this piano concert was the contest was the first thing in my entire life I ever did for God. Everything else was to prove a point. Now, she would ask God, and she was just weeping, and she's saying, and you know what I'm talking about, don't you? And I said, yes, I do. Now, she was not irreligious. This is a spiritual leader on campus. She was praying diligently that God would help her do the best in everything she did. But her goal for doing the best was to prove her dad wrong. And the intensity, God used the intensity to begin to destroy her physically. I can tell you a story of another guy about the same time. The fact that it happened, about that time we had about 6 of them in a row. And there was another guy who was a married student, but he was only about first semester in his junior year, something like that. And he was starting to have numbness in his legs, in his right leg, and it kept getting worse and worse, and finally he was on crutches. It went through the same scenario. Our clinic sent him to a neurologist. Neurologist said, you need to see a shrink. And I guess I'm the closest thing to a shrink on our campus. So he came in, and I said, well, let's talk about it. And as obvious, again, is a very intense person. And I said, why the intensity? What is your goal? He said, and again, it was a divorce situation. His dad had always been down on him. And his goal was, he was a sacred music major, and his goal was to become the number one church choir director in the world. Now, that's pretty high goal, because I think there's only one of those. and nobody knows who it is, but if you're going to be the number one, there is only one. And intensity. I mean, everything he did. He's the kind of guy you'd love to have work for you. So is this girl. You'd love to have him work for you because they'll do everything right. And they'll be exceedingly respectful while they're doing it. And they'll be just diligent. And they'll be just right there. And everything will be done exactly right. You don't have to worry about anything. But their goal was to be self-insured. I've got to prove something to these people. I'm going to show them that I'm not what they said I am, or I'm going to show them that they're not going to mess up my life. And when I was seeing him for a couple of weeks, when I met with him, he was on crutches. 2 weeks later, after he'd repented and got that right with God, he was without his crutches. And he wasn't making that up. But intensity will destroy you. You can't handle the uncertainties of life with more intensity. You have to bow more. You have to depend more. You can't fight more and win it. And back to our verse, chapter 4, 11, 4, he that observeth the wind shall not sow, and he that regardeth the cloud shall not reap. It takes enormous energy to push and control your world. And by the way, this doesn't always happen to... These were not loud, dominating people. These were just what would appear in your church as just the faithful workers. I mean, this guy and this girl would be at church every time it's open. They would be volunteering to play the piano and to help out in the choir and to do anything. They would be just out there, but their goal was, I've got to do this to prove that I'm not what other people think I am, and all this kind of thing. Other people have had some bad things happen to them, and they're not going to let bad things happen anymore. I'm going to be in control. I'm going to know what's going on. And they attack life's uncertainties with intensity. That will destroy you physically as well as destroy your relationship with God. It's not hard to understand what they're doing when you understand the way down, because it begins with a dissatisfaction. There's something I don't like, and I'm going to ensure that it happens the way I want it. That's one way to handle mystery, attack it. There's another way, and we've already discussed this a little bit, and that is to avoid it. Avoid it with passivity. Sorry, here. Avoid it with passivity. Retreat. And I've already talked about that a little bit. That can be procrastination. Procrastination can be just laziness. But procrastination can be afraid to tackle responsibilities because I don't know exactly the right way to do it. I talk with students who will not get started on a paper because they're perfectionistic, and they won't get started on a paper because they haven't figured out the perfect way to do it yet. And they don't have the perfect time to do all of the research at once the way they would like to do it. They think the way to start the research is to have a 3-hour block of time that you can devote exactly to research on the paper. Folks, 3-hour blocks of time don't exist in college. They don't exist very much in life, where you have a 3-hour free block of time where you're going to do this project. You have to use the Swiss cheese method. Shoot a lot of holes in that responsibility. Attack this part of it and this part of it and do a little bit here and a little bit there. But a perfectionist who has to have everything in control and who has a spirit of fear won't even start it unless the perfect way to come has come along to handle the problem. And they have all kinds of projects in the garage that they have just started and never finished, and closets full of craft projects. They've done the first 10 minutes and then something distracted them, and they haven't got the last, they haven't yet found a 3-hour block of time to go back and get it. You don't need a 3-hour block of time. If it's important to do, spend 10 minutes on it. Next time you get 10 minutes, spend 10 minutes on it again. Some of the, most of the procrastinators I talk with are highly perfectionistic people. And they have an idea that sounds really good. It goes like this. If you're going to do a job, you may as well do it right. The problem is they never get it done at all. Because there's no good way to start in their mind, and there's no good time to start it. I run into this, and we run into this all the time. I'm not picking on anybody here. It's a very common dilemma of people who have a spirit of fear. And they avoid it. Look, and it becomes, you can procrastinate out of this perfectionism kind of thing. And it's a dependence on myself. I know how to do it, and my standard is we do it right. And if there's not a chance to do it right, then we don't do it. Do you see the pride that goes behind that? I do it. Other people might tackle a little bit at a time, and they might do a slipshod job, but not me. I do it right for the glory of God. Amen. And they never end up getting it done at all, to the dishonor of the glory of God, because of the personal pride that says, I've got to do it right, or we won't do it at all. And you know, with all the uncertainties in life, we really don't have many of those ideal opportunities. Sometimes when I'm challenging the student leaders and I say, look, you need to be talking to these people in your room who are having problems. And then the question is, well, when is a good time to handle this? A good time to talk with somebody about a problem is any time it's not a bad time. Because we wait for this ideal time, you know, when everything is kind of neat in the room and everybody's kind of warm and fuzzy, and then then we don't want to talk because we don't want to ruin the atmosphere. And when they come in real growly and, you know, this kind of thing, we don't want to talk then because they're in a bad mood. So we're waiting around for this ideal time. The ideal time is any time it's not a genuinely bad time. And that's good for procrastinators. When is the ideal time to start this? Anytime it's really not a bad time to start it. But we can avoid, and instead of persevering boldly, instead of fearfully, we can avoid with passivity. It can be perfectionism, that kind of personal dependency, the pride driving that. It can just be plain lazy. Proverbs talks a lot about the slothful man. I have a theory about Proverbs that the slothful man is married to the contentious woman. You know, and she is contentious because he's lazy. You know, the roof is leaking water, you know, and she's saying, honey, the roof leaks. And he says, why? I can't fix it now. It's raining. So then tomorrow it's not raining, and she says, now why don't you fix the roof? And he said, honey, it's not leaking. You know, and so it never gets done. And that makes her contentious. She's like a continual dropping. Now he's got a leaky roof and a dripping wife. You know, it's like a continual leak too. We can call this hyper-perfectionism, where it never gets started on things and avoids things instead of persevering boldly. The paralysis of analysis. We just spend so much time trying to figure out exactly the way to do it. It never gets started. And you know what you got to face, folks, on this, is that this is a fallen planet. There aren't many ideal things about anything. So you do what you do with what you got, in a contented fashion, because this is what God has given you. And no, he hasn't given you the perfect way to do that, and the perfect time to do that, and the perfect help to do that, and the perfect health to do it. But you joyfully are content with what God's given you. You get on with your business, and you sow, and you put 110% in what he's given you to do, and just go do it. And Solomon is saying, persevere boldly instead of fearfully. Basically, face your limitations, and while leaving the results to God, work hard. Verse 5, as thou knowest not what is the way of the spirit, nor how the bones do grow in the womb of her that is with child, even so thou knowest not the works of God who maketh all. Can you really know the works of God and what he's doing? No. So just get busy. Don't try to figure it all out. Verse 6, in the morning, look at verse 6, sow thy seed. And in the evening, withhold not thine hand. Do what you're supposed to be doing then. For thou knowest not whether it shall prosper either this or that, or whether they both shall be alike good. He's saying, what kind of chores do you got? Well, I got this to do over here, and I got to do that, and I got to do that. But I don't know which one's going to be best. Well, just do what you can in all of them. You don't know which one's going to be good and which one is going to fall apart. You plant a garden. Which plants are going to live and which ones will die? You don't know. You plant them all and you water them all and you weed them all. Some come up and some don't. That's up to God. And I tell you what, folks, the more our world falls apart, I mean, we haven't seen anything yet. 9/11 showed us that one event can throw our economy into shambles. And you know, we probably have artificially recovered a little bit. There are not many more points the Fed can go down. We have another event. The airlines are already belly up. And the economy in all kinds of other sectors is laying off people and we haven't even had another attack yet. Uncertainty hasn't hit us yet. And Solomon is teaching us how to handle uncertainty. You don't know where the tree is going to fall. And whether it's going to fall to the north or to the south. And you don't know which plant's going to come up. So what do? You just get out there and plant. And you get out there and weed. And you get out there and water. And you do what you can. And you leave the rest to God. But you don't, in a spirit of fear, just recoil and say, and get paralyzed in fear. That's anxiety. It'll lead to despair. Focus on your contribution, not the outcome. What can I do today? You don't know how it's going to turn out. I don't know how my kids are going to turn out. None of us know how our kids are going to turn out. We're not prophets. You can't focus on how it's going to come out. You don't know what it's going to do. But you can focus on today, what you need to do today. Some people are saying, if I let my kid do this, he's going to go there. We do need to be wise. But we can get into a what-if paralysis about everything. Say, if I let them cross the street over there, if I let them ride his bike over here, a car might hit him. That's true, a car might. But, well, then fence him in the yard then for the rest of his life. I'm not saying be irresponsible, just let your kids wild. There are a lot of people who ought to put their kids in a fence. But there are a lot of people who are just paralyzed by all of the fear. Teach your kids how to be responsible and put them in situations where they can, I think one of the greatest things you can do is get your kids in a summer camp. But I don't know how you do up there. Well, you won't know until you try. And then when he has problems up there, then you can bring him home and then you can deal with him about why he's having those problems. The goal isn't to keep him home the rest of his life. The goal is to put him in a controlled environment where he can have his problems and not mess up so badly, and then bring him back in and help him with those problems so the next time you send him out, he doesn't have those problems. And get him in a summer camp in the summer working up there. Instead of clustering him, say, he might have a problem. Of course he might have a problem. He's your kid. My kids have problems because they're my kids. We're fallen people with fallen children. Every time they have a problem, that's God's way of showing us another area we need to work. Boy, don't fuss when your kids have problems. Thank God they're having problems while they're still living in your house. When you can do something about it. Now, all I'm saying, folks, yes, there's a lot of uncertainty in life, but there's a God in heaven over all of this. And you don't be naive and just, like the fool, you don't pay any attention to the dangers involved. But at the same time, you can get so paralyzed, you never get going on anything. At the bottom of page number 6, it says, faith in Christ does not relieve anyone of hard work. It only makes it possible to get on with the job in a joyful spirit that expects God's blessing, whatever the immediate outcome may be. Our confidence is not, please note, in some mystical assurance of success in all we do. It is rather a confidence in the Lord Himself and an assurance by faith that whatever happens there will be a blessing in it for us. Our labor is not in vain in the Lord, 1 Corinthians 15:58 tells us. Folks, we work not to guarantee our success and outcome. We work because it show, because God said for us to work. It shows we honor Him by our obedience. And if you have trouble understanding what I'm talking about, go back to chapter 13 and change into His image and read about three kinds of farmers. Because there is that controlling farmer. And that's what I'm describing here. So, persevere boldly. But another thing, persevere joyfully, not passively in this world of mystery. Wonderful passages here. Verse 7, he says, enjoy the gifts of youth. Truly the light is sweet and a pleasant thing it is for the eyes to behold the sun. The twofold description here, as your notes say, of light and sweet, implies that life is not only good in itself, but that it is to be savored with enthusiasm as one might enjoy honey. And he's saying here at the end of chapter 11, enjoy life while you can when you're young, because there's going to come a time when the old gray mare ain't what she used to be. And I'm feeling some of that, and some of you are. You won't be an Energizer rabbit forever. Number two, enjoy the gifts of youth, but remember first, remember they don't last forever. Verse 8. But if a man live many years and rejoice in them all, yet let him remember the days of darkness, for they shall be many. All that cometh is vanity. In other words, enjoy it, but understand that that enjoyment won't last forever. There is a difficult time coming. Folks, there's a difficult time coming for all of us. How do you get ready for the difficult times? You store up, what I call the Joseph principle. You store up in times of plenty for times of need. When you have your mind about you and your energy about you, you ought to be memorizing and meditating on Scripture a lot. Why? Because there's going to come a time when you won't be able to see well, and you won't be able to hear well, and you'll only be able to live on what you've put in your own soul and treasured up and valued and been illuminated by. And if you don't have anything there in those times, you're going to have a real rough time. I think a great example of that is Pete Stevenson. For years, he's been having eye difficulty and eye operations. And ever since he learned, maybe 8 or 9 years ago, that he would probably be going blind, he has memorized Scripture like you wouldn't believe. That's the Joseph principle. You store up in times of plenty for times of need. Because the times of need are coming. Remember, they don't last forever. He's talking to young people. Enjoy the gifts of youth, but remember, they don't last forever, and you are responsible for your choices. Verse 9, he says, rejoice, O young man, in thy youth, and let thy heart cheer thee in the days of thy youth, and walk in the ways of thine heart, and in the sight of thine eyes. But know thou that for all these things God will bring thee into judgment. Verse 20, therefore, remove sorrow from thine heart, and put away evil from thy flesh, or anger from your flesh, Therefore remove sorrow or anger from thy heart and put away evil from thy flesh, for childhood and youth are vanity, or they're going to be very fleeting. So therefore, he says, to enjoy your time of youth, put away your anger at life's vexations. The statement after point A in your notes say, the vanity of the world easily induces in us vexation. That's the word sorrow in our authorized version. It means anger or vexation, which hinders the joyful life of faith. The danger is that vexation over the enigmas and irritations of life will grip the heart, and that disillusionment will lead to cynicism. If we are to live a life of joy, we must learn to cope with cynicism at its root. Put away your anger at life's vexations, and don't harm your body while you live. Verse 10b, put away evil from thy flesh. Don't harm your body with what you're doing. The statement after that says the expression, put away evil from thy flesh, is not primarily a warning against sins of lust, but it is advice not to suffer pain unnecessarily. This is indicated both by the context and by the use of the Hebrew word raha, which denotes physical and material calamity or misfortune. This obviously refers to hardship and suffering he brings as a consequence of sin. He says, all right, you're in the youth, you need to enjoy your youth. Be content, be joyful in what got hard, learn how to weather these calamities and fluctuations that come in life, and store up for the future because hard times are coming, and learn how to deal with these fluctuations without vexation, because it will bring detriment to your body. Another reminder of sowing and reaping. Dr. Bob Senior used to put it this way: every dissipation of youth is paid for by a draft on old age. In other words, every time in your youth you try to cut corners on doing right, you're going to pay for it later on. Every dissipation of youth or evil indulgence of youth will be paid for by a draft on old age. As I mentioned to you, I'm very concerned about the indications of the way down that I see in young people. The discontent, the dissatisfaction, the high level of anxiety with a lot of young people, and even the despair in a lot of young people. We used to think despair was an old person's disease. There are teenagers by the thousands attempting to take their lives all the time. They haven't learned how to deal with dissatisfaction on its beginning level. So, conclusion here: what is the secret of persevering in light of the unsolved mysteries? What is a mortal to do? You're to persevere wisely in all of this. You're to persevere boldly, not fearfully. You're to persevere joyfully, not passively, in the world of mystery. A lot of important lessons here. We're going to pick up probably some of the more sobering things, even more sobering things, tomorrow morning as we finish this up, when he tells us to remember our Creator in the days of our youth, for the evil days are coming. And we'll look at that in the morning, a little bit more about persevering joyfully, and we're going to look at one more way to persevere tomorrow morning as we wind up discourse number 4. And then we'll look at the conclusion of the book in the final session, in session 13. So, hope you come. Get some sleep. You don't have to be here till 9. And get some sleep and eat your breakfast and be here, and we'll pick up with that. Let's pray. Lord Jesus, if we're honest with ourselves, we see that there is much fluctuation in the circumstances of life. And we look around at the world around us and how they are partying to deal with the uncertainties just in order to forget them. They're doing drugs, they're drinking, they're living out illicit relationships, looking for extreme adventures. And Lord, bless us tonight as we rest. Give us a good rest and bring us refreshed in the morning to learn the final things you have for us from your word. We pray in your name. Amen.